Welcome to the Legacy and Faith Show, featuring estate and tax attorney Paul Grant. The Legacy and Faith Show is about the journey of discovering how to create plans that protect wealth and family values for generations. And now the host of the Legacy and Faith Show, Paul Grant.
Along with co-host Mark Holland, it's another edition of the Legacy and Faith Show with Paul Grant. Hi there, Paul.
Hi, Mark.
Good to see you in studio once again.
Yes.
And you are sporting quite a buzz cut.
I know.
You
I
said
do.
Somebody
a new
thought
hairstyle.
Maybe you lost a bet or
yeah,
something.
That's right. Yeah. So,
no.
You know, you got to change it up sometimes. Guys, you can either grow beards or we can get different haircuts. So yeah, I went with the different haircut.
So maybe, and I'm growing the beard. So we're equal there. Although I will be cutting that soon. Hey, this week today, we are talking about a new series. And this is something we've discussed, I don't know how much on the program. I know behind the scenes, I've talked to you about some of the challenges I faced being an executor of
right.
several different trusts and the family turmoil that can cost.
Yep.
That can come from that. And you want to talk about the battle for money this week.
Yeah, it's really a difficult place to think that our family is going to start a battle, that they're going to be after the money. As a matter of fact, I don't know if I really have a client that believes they're family is going to walk away after their death and have hard feelings towards one another and even family splits, let alone walk into litigation, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, there are some families that are a little more realistic of, oh, hey, watch after this kid. Okay, mm-hmm. I appreciate mm-hmm. knowing who the trouble spots are going to be, or the kids that are a little more money hungry. But I really think that a high majority of clients I don't want to call it naivety, but it's kind of the parent blinder, which is, no, my kids won't do that. They'll actually pull together and behave. And the unfortunate part is that in Washington state alone, 20% of wills end up being challenged one way or another.
Wow.
So that seems to be a strikingly high
actually formally challenged in court.
Yeah, actually, yeah, that there is something going on in court that someone brings forth a challenge or petition or complaint to the court. And so I guess the thing we want to look at with this show is, if I know where the weak spots potentially are, in other words, what do people challenge? What have I seen over my career? What have I heard through reading cases, because that's a part of my job as an attorney, is that I read a lot of cases. That tells me what to look at from my documents. It tells me what to look at as far as shoring up how I help clients. It tells me what to look at for the law to make sure that everything is stable. But it also tells me, what are people thinking out there? What are other attorneys going to do if indeed we have a disgruntled beneficiary and they go, enough is enough, I'm going to come forward and I'm actually going to start taking action? But it doesn't even have to reach that level, right, Mark? Mm-hmm. I've mentioned many times on this show that if leaving something behind to my two daughters causes their relationship to be worse off, then I would rather die with nothing.
Yeah.
And so it may never reach the area of litigation. It may never reach the court. But what happens to the family? Mm. And so I want to take a look at four different areas and talk through these specific thoughts of, where are the shortcomings? Where are people looking to attack? Where can the hurt feelings start to arise? Because if we can shore up our document, if we can make it better, and if we can then make sure that our current documents don't have these weaknesses, then we have a far greater opportunity to make a plan that is actually going to keep family unity and actually pass on a blessing called money that will be used by them wisely. So,
one question I have before we get into this is, does the size of the estate determine the feelings more or less, or does it matter? It doesn't matter how big the estate is, these same things are going to apply.
Yeah, I don't think the estate size really matters. Mm-hmm. It really becomes more about, where are their legal weaknesses? Where are their family weaknesses in the plan? And you know, people can fight over $50,000 just as vigorously as fighting over $5 million. Mm-hmm. So I'm not so sure that the size of the estate is a key indicator that there's going to be a greater likelihood mm-hmm. of family difficulty and or accountability and or someone just simply being greedy.
Okay.
But yes, I mean, if we've got $5 million on the table, is there a greater likelihood that somebody that is going to do something?
I would think it would.
I think what ends up happening is that those cases end up becoming longer in nature because there's so much at stake versus smaller estates may.
But the same principles apply no matter how.
I really do think that across the board that. That regardless of the money value that is being looked at, because a lot of these places where weaknesses happen in estate planning is over stuff. It's mm-hmm. really not over the dollar value because I can't split a picture into. I can't split a wedding ring into. I can't split stuff. So that's really one of the first places. Okay. And I've talked about that on different shows, which is the stuff actually matters more than the bank account because that's where a lot of the family dynamics come forward. Mm-hmm. And then if the family dynamics start at the stuff level, then it's going to potentially gravitate to the money level.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's look at these four areas.
Yeah. So there's four areas that I want to talk about and let's put them out on the table first. Yeah. So number one is that the plan itself. So the legal language or the language of the will or trust that may not be at its highest best level. Okay. And so we'll talk about those issues. Administrating the plan, whether someone has been incapacitated. So maybe we have a power of attorney who is managing the money before someone passes away. There's a caretaker involved. There's other things going on versus when someone dies, what is the administrative necessities after that point? So there's two places where administratively a plan could go awry, whether someone's incapacitated and then again at death. And then number three, this is always the big estate planning problem, which is blended families. Mm-hmm. And it could be a second marriage, even with adult kids. So blended families, that tends to be a very hot spot. That's actually where I see a lot of litigation mm-hmm. come out of. Mm-hmm. And then similar but to the administration level, but what happens if someone is incompetent or if we have a compromised adult with diminished capacity, failing health, and we need to have other people help them. Typically, one child helps the parent, and then all of a sudden the parent starts feeling more beholden to that person. Or sometimes an outside caretaker starts putting their finger into the mix. So we're going to talk about that as well. So these are the four areas: language of the plan, administrating it, blended families or remarriage issues, and then incompetency and or assistance during lifetime. So
okay, well, let's start on the language part. This is the part that you're the most involved in because you're the one who designs these trusts and wills.
Right. Yes. And so language can only be created by an attorney. Well, actually, nowadays, that's not true. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there's a lot of ways you can get an estate plan. Mm. You can go online and you can grab an estate plan, a template, and do it yourself.
You can really do it yourself now?
Oh, well,
and it's
sure.
Legal?
Sure.
Binding? Okay.
So a document can be binding if it meets certain criteria. And so wills need to be signed. They need to have witnesses. Trust documents need to be notarized. They need to have a couple other legal requirements. But regardless, yes, there are more do-it-yourselfers out there with the invention of Google. Mm-hmm. AI is now starting to be a buzzword of, well, is AI going to take over the attorney world? And so, yes, you can go online and you can get a template. I remember all the way back when, even before I was an attorney, that like Staples or you go to an office supply store – And
really?
and there was new software of wills and powers of attorney, and so they've always been selling packages.
Okay.
And whether it's been on a disk, on an actual disk that you put in your computer, or nowadays there's websites specifically designed that you can go and download or ask certain questions. And really what you're going to get with any of those type of opportunities is very templated, basic language. As a matter of fact, if you take a moment and look at any of those websites, read the disclaimer language. Mm. And if you are about ready to do legal work with disclaimer language that is 3 pages long, you may want to stop and rethink what you're doing. Mm. And really the disclaimer language, what they're doing is saying, hey, we're not giving you any advice. We're not saying that these comply with your state law, and we're not going to tell you how to do this. We're just going to give you a templated version of what you can and can't do, or give you a base document. Now, I've mentioned this many times on multiple radio shows, which is you get what you pay for. We all know this. And so if you're going to pay $70 for a will online, you're going to get a $70 will. Mm. And our entire discussion today is about the battle for money. So if you really want to do a number on your kids, either one, do it yourself. Number two, create like a scavenger hunt out of your will and just make them go find all the money. Either of those is going to be a great opportunity to bring in family dynamics and potentially demonstrate the weakness that I'm talking about. So the first thing is, when we look at language, when we look at documents, the question is, where did you even get the document? Did you do it yourself? Did you have an attorney do it? So then a couple things that I would want to know if you were coming into my office, which, and you were asking me to review your plan and say, is this going to be sufficient for my personal needs? One of my questions is, well, where did you get the document? Who did it for you? Mm. There's a lot of well-meaning attorneys out there, very intelligent people. But if they don't focus on this area of law, if they're not keeping up with the current law, then they may be using a templated version as well. Mm. And again, not that templates are fundamentally wrong. It's just that there are going to be potential language issues or areas that are not addressed in the overall estate plan that an attorney who actually focuses on estate planning and is keeping up with tax issues, keeping up with legal issues, keeping up with case law, and making sure that their documents are that, first of all, the foundation of their documents is that legal issues are high, are updated and at their highest best use. Mm. But also there's an experience factor of what questions are being asked and how does an attorney lead you through making the decisions over each thing that needs to be input into the plan. So when we look at the first part of language and documents, then where those documents are coming from is a really big deal. And yes, the language absolutely is critical to ensure that the document is going to actually perform at and when it's necessary. So whether it's incompetency or whether it's at death, we need to have a document at its highest best use with the best legal language, the best tax language that can be afforded at that time. So documents, they are critical and they matter where you get them from.
Okay, talking about the battle for money this week, the areas that a beneficiary can attack an estate plan, things in order so that that doesn't happen and it's not a successful attack, as they say.
Right.
People are intrigued. We'll take a break here, but they want to find out more from you. How do they do that, Paul?
Head over to our website, legacyandfaith.com, where you can find past podcasts, upcoming educational opportunities, ways to communicate with us, all found at legacyandfaith.com.
Back with more of the Legacy and Faith Show with Paul Grant in just a moment.
Can I avoid probate? Will I lose everything if my health becomes compromised? How do I preserve what I have for me and my family? Will the government take it all? This is Paul Grant with the Legacy and Faith Show. These are some of the most common questions we get on a daily basis, and there are solutions for all of these issues. It is time for you to protect your family and what God has placed under your stewardship, and we can help. Go to legacyandfaith.com to find out more about our services and upcoming educational opportunities. That's legacyandfaith.com.
Your photos, slides, scrapbooks, and home movies are invaluable and irreplaceable. Barry Kenny here with the Bear Services. Call us to save them as digital files to be stored electronically and shared liberally. We will even come to you so they stay in your possession. Go to thebearservices.com for more information. That's thebearservices.com.
We now return to the Legacy and Faith Show, featuring estate and tax attorney Paul Grant, and continue today's practical discussion to apply biblical principles for kingdom purposes.
Along with co-host Mark Holland, looking at the battle for money, the areas that beneficiaries can attack an estate plan, the discussion this week, and the first area is the language of the document, and you want to continue on this part of the plan. I was going to say the plan, Stan, but the plan, Paul.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And the documents matter because they are ultimately what we have when someone else passes. In other words, that is your voice. Whether you created it, whether you read it intently, or whether you just walked in and signed it. This is your voice after you no longer have a voice. So therefore, the language is paramount. And one of the things concerning the document that I find often is that many people have done an estate plan, but it's been a long time. Mm. The average plan before individuals relook at it is almost 20 years. Mm. Now, over a 20-year span, I don't know about anyone else's life, but there's a lot that has changed in the past 20 years of my life. Mm. And I can tell you as an attorney who watches language and watches over tax issues, they are always moving. So it's a very clear an easy question to answer, which is 20 years too long? Heck yes. There is absolutely, that is way too long of a period between an estate plan done and now needing to use it. What if you pass away or become incompetent in year 15? I'm telling you from my perspective, it is very difficult to make a 15-year-old document work in either of those circumstances. And if I have to work hard, then that means that's just attorney speak for you're going to be charged a lot more. So it is far cheaper. It is far superior to continually update your estate plan and ensure that the language, both legal and tax issues, are always at their highest best use. Because I don't know when someone is going to need to use their plan. I don't know the day that my memory starts to fade and other people start noticing it. I don't know the day that I am ultimately called home to see my Savior. And so if I cannot perfectly predict those two major events, then I need to make sure that I'm doing my part to leave clear, updated documents behind. See, the individual who's going to really struggle with this is if I have memory issues, if I have health issues, and someone else needs to stand next to me, an agent, a representative for me, they're the person that is going to experience the hardship when they're using an old document. Mm-hmm. So they go to the bank and the bank goes, wow, this is so old. We have to send it back to our legal department, which most of them don't have anyways. But they send it back to their legal department and it's weeks until they decide, yeah, that's okay. Or actually, no, we're not going to honor it. And then what? Mm-hmm. Now we're stuck. And all during that time, bills aren't being paid or we're not able to sufficiently step in and assist the person that we need to help. So the real person that you are helping is the individual that is going to come alongside you for that journey to assist you during your lifetime. And we don't want a super old document if we pass away.
So how often should the document then be updated? You say 20 years is too long.
Yeah, too long.
So for somebody who's healthy and going cruising along, what, every 5 years or?
Yeah, so when I first started my practice in the Seattle area, then I went to probably 25 different banks, introduced myself as being a new office in the area. And I asked them this specific question, which is, how old do you want to see a power of attorney if you had to use it? So if a client came in, or rather the agent came in and said, I am the Smith power of attorney, how old do you want that document? And they said that they do not want a document more than 3 years old. Hmm. So from a financial institution perspective, 3 years is kind of their sweet spot. So if one of the main objectives of a financial power of attorney is to ensure that we have the ability to manage your finances, I'm not so sure I want to be pushing against what the financial institutions desire. Mm-hmm. So I would say anywhere between 3 and 5 years. My program, which is unique in the Pacific Northwest, is that we update client documents every 3 years. Why? Because that's exactly what the banks wanted. So every 3 years in my system, in my process, clients come back and we update and fully print their entire trust again, all their financial and healthcare power of attorneys, their end of life documents. So in our system, it's a 3-year cycle to ensure that everything is updated so that nothing is older than that. And I can also tell you from, you know, again, from my attorney perspective, boy, the amount of changes I make in my documents within a 3-year period is actually quite astounding. Hmm. And so if you have an attorney that focuses in on estate planning, then number one, the question is, what type of program do they have to make sure that your documents are updated? But number two, how many different changes have they made over the course of the past couple of years? Boy, I could tell you, 5 major legal adjustments that I've made over the past couple of years alone. Okay. So documents need to be updated. They should not be that old. But yet what I find is that this estate planning drill, people get either into the mentality of I did it, and so I'm good to go. Again, my question is for how long? Well, until something changes. And so I don't want clients to be lulled into a longer period of time. It should be brought back to their attention more often.
Okay. The next area of language is who prepared it. And
we covered that, yeah, okay. Which is attorneys and or are you doing it yourself?
Okay. And how are assets titled compared to the estate plan?
Yeah, this is a big one as well. This is an administrative nightmare, which is when you develop a will or a trust, then your assets need to be titled accordingly, and or the beneficiaries need to be matching the decisions you just made. So there's oftentimes beneficiary, like transfer on death, so bank accounts, life insurance policies, IRAs, 401ks, other tax-deferred accounts. If we don't have the beneficiary aligned with the plan that we just created, then there is a gap in the planning. And unfortunately, I've seen this multiple times, which is someone has a trust, but then the asset is not titled in the trust. Well, then how does the trust instructions, where we just spent a lot of time, effort, and money creating this estate plan, if the asset is not in the name of the trust, then how does the trust language ever influence that asset? Chances are it's not going to. Or if we created a will and we changed how the estate is going to be given. So we are giving money to grandchildren or we're including grandchildren, but then the beneficiary designation on most of our assets are just to the kids. Mm. Well, then there's very, very little left over in the estate to actually match the intentionality of the client because the assets don't match and they're not aligned and they're not integrated. So that's kind of what we call it, financial integration. Mm. The finances are not integrated into the plan. So now we have two different plans. We have the assets doing one thing, but the estate plan doing another. A good estate planner will help a client bring the assets into alignment so that the plan and the assets are always serving the same purpose and are moving towards the same goal that was created in the plan itself. And, you know, one other thing is that I just mentioned grandchildren. So one of the other things about the language in the documents is that depending on the document itself, you may have included multiple beneficiaries during your lifetime that you need to care for. And so there is very tricky language when you start adding other people. If you have a special needs child or if you have minor children, what rights do they have to your estate during your lifetime? If you became incompetent or needed assistance, that becomes a really tricky area in estate planning to not forget to include others. But when you do, then it also sets up the opportunity for a little bit of a conflict potentiality. So therefore, multiple beneficiaries and documents is also something that we need to be careful of.
Okay, talking about the battle for money, the areas that a beneficiary can attack an estate plan, how to protect your documents and your trust from these kinds of attacks, these kinds of ambiguities. Just starting to scratch the surface here on this subject. We'll continue it next time. People are intrigued, though, Paul. They want to find out more about your services. How do they do that?
Yeah, I would love to sit down with you, meet you, get to know you and your goals. You can head over to our website, legacyandfaith.com. There's ways to communicate with us, upcoming educational opportunities, past podcasts for more education as well, all found at legacyandfaith.com.
It's the Legacy and Faith Show with Paul Grant.
Thank you for joining us for the Legacy and Faith Show. You can find more information about the show and Paul Grant at legacyandfaith.com. Join us next week at the same time as we learn to build God's kingdom and continue our journey on how to protect wealth and family values for generations. All discussions on the Legacy and Faith Show are intended to be about general legal issues. If a situation applies to you, then we encourage you to seek specific legal advice. Please do not rely upon any discussions from this program in place of having a personal relationship with your attorney. Any listener question that may have been answered also does not constitute legal advice and does not establish a client-attorney relationship.